Hello.
Hi there, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
All right. So, I am on the phone with Dr. Reed, who has created Dr. Reed's Day School. And as a nation, the number of young people who are undereducated feel like they don't belong and that their life is devoid of meaning. That number is increasing. With that, they resort to negative coping strategies. So Dr. Reed created a new view as a role of an educator. And the position of Dr. Reed's Day School, which I pulled from the website, is that if they were to take a different approach and teachers become culture brokers, we can find a new way to make the classroom a fruitful area of learning. So, Dr. Reed, can you tell me what it means when you say turn teachers into culture brokers?
Well, the whole theory came about actually when I was studying education in Africa and why I'm a science teacher at the beginning of my career. That's how I started. And what we look at in science a lot is conceptual change and how we're going to be able to help children to shift their ideas, their cosmologies about life. And what we realize with that is that you really have to be able to consider their lens. What is their former experience as a child? What are they going home to and their friends? And if they're looking through a lens that's completely foreign from what you're trying to introduce to them, they won't understand what. And but if you actually come at it from you're understanding their culture and you're helping them to bridge the gap between what they need to learn and their present ideas about things, then you can be a culture broker.
Okay, so you in essence, you're using the students' worldviews and experiences to enhance their learning experiences.
Yes, absolutely.
And on your website, it said that they have a very personalized curriculum. How do you get them to participate in creating that curriculum? I imagine that once they get there, they're so frustrated with school, it seems like it would be hard.
We do. We have to do a lot of kind of repair, I guess. Our children are quite exceptional, and so they're coming from a place where they've been very misunderstood because in one area they're demonstrating these amazing strengths, and then but then they're not performing, and so people think that they're lazy or they're being defiant or something like that. And so when they get come to us, we our mission is to respect their inner dignity and help them to realize their true potential. And I think the most important thing you can do is to take some time to learn about what they care about and what's going to light their fire, and just let them know that you believe in them and they can trust you to start taking risks to learn, because that's what learning is taking risks.
Absolutely. And so each of those students have, they lead kind of their own path. Is that how you have it worked out?
Well, I don't think that there's anything wrong with benchmarks or standards. I think that where things go wrong is when you're teaching through a standardized test, and where you're teaching groups instead of facilitating a child's learning, an individual child's learning. And so, we go in, let's say we're working with a third grader. First and foremost, what are the strengths and how can we engage that child? And, while we're working on whatever reading benchmarks they need to be meeting, then we build in these kind of things that excite them, but also the scaffolds they need to overcome a lot of their academic challenges that hold them back.
So at your school, you take in twice exceptional children. So the ones that are high in intellectual ability in one area, but also have learning difficulties. Can you talk a little bit about your process of choosing students that fit that model?
Well, they usually find us. They kind of, they're it's their kids who have just demonstrated that they're so capable, but they just, for whatever reason, and there are several, the typical school environment does not work. And so it can be an auditory processing disorder. It can be visual processing, dyslexia, ADHD. A lot of our kids are labeled with autism. Some are on the spectrum, some are not. But a lot of them are misdiagnosed because of, especially auditory processing is the one that people really confuse for a lot of other, they're over-medicating and that kind of thing. But when the kids get to a smaller, nurturing, you know, less stimulating environment, they can calm themselves enough to be receptive to new information.
Right. Yeah, it can be pretty overwhelming when you're responding to a lot of stimulus in the environment and you're still trying to pick up what's going on in the room.
And I'm sorry, I didn't answer your question very well. We do look at like a cognitive test, so their ability to test. And for twice exceptional children, at least one of the scores needs to be in the gifted range. But we usually see a big discrepancy with very high verbal comprehension or perceptual reasoning, but, you know, relatively low working memory or processing speed.
Right. Yeah, that sounds typical of a lot of the children that that I saw as a special education teacher, where they were, you know, higher in a lot of areas, and then they just couldn't hold things in their short-term memory long enough to put it in long-term to get it so they can pull it up quickly.
Right, that's a good way to describe that.
Yeah. So, I have a child with autism myself, and his IQ, and I'm sorry about the barking in the background. I don't know what's going on in my house.
But, no problem. I have dogs too.
So the do you find that IQ tests are truly representative of what an autistic child is intellectually capable of doing?
I think that they can demonstrate. The children are so complex that we need to be careful with putting a label or a number on anything. Labels make me nervous. Because I think once we see a label, we decide that there's a certain path we go down, and we stop being curious about what can actually help children or what's really going on. So, you know, we look at scores and they can tell us that they've, you know, we're just picking up little pieces of evidence along the way of, you know, how we can best reach children. And, you know, what we find out that a lot of our kids are dysgraphic, for example, through testing. So I don't think it's the end all. It depends on who is doing the testing, if they're qualified and if they're familiar with working with different types of children, then I think you can usually get a pretty good read. But it's hard to say. Every child is different.
Absolutely. So when you're teaching these children, what do you think is the single most important thing that you take away from the experience? In other words, what should parents think about when it comes to ensuring the best education for their children, whether they have autism, learning disabilities, or other exceptionalities?
I think that communication is essential. You know, as parents are kind of gearing up for this school year to begin, if you can be a team member from the beginning with your teacher. I know I taught for a number of years, and I had children in my class who had learning disabilities, and I didn't know. And halfway through the year, when I wasn't reaching them, I was wishing I'd had that information, because it's heartbreaking to feel like you're not doing what you can for kids. So I write a letter to the teacher and say, this is my child, and here's how you can partner with us to make sure that they have a great year. Also, I know with our students, they have very misleading behaviors. So, you know, if you see Billy starting to get up and walk away from his desk, it's probably not because he's being defiant, but it's because he doesn't understand the directions, or he's frustrated because he can't do what you're asking him to do. You know, give kids the benefit of the doubt. They all want to do their best.
They do. I agree with you on that. That reminds me of there was a student that I had last year, and he was extremely intelligent. But when he was in the classroom, he would just shut down. And he had a lot of things memorized. He could tell me an answer to a question, but he couldn't bring up the process of how he got to it. And so, even though he was very, very smart and knew how to get to the answer somewhere in there, and now the way schools are, they have to provide these explanations. That piece of it was so hard for him that it took me a better part of the year to get him to come up to the board to work a problem out because he didn't know how to show his steps. So,
Fascinating little people.
yes, they are. They are. But, that parent to teacher relationship is extremely important. And I agree with you on that. And I can speak for myself and for a lot of the teachers that I work with that, a vast majority of the teachers have the children's best interest in mind and want to be helpful. But then, if there are special schools like the one that you have and they find that school and they feel like that their child is not going to function in a regular school, I noticed that the tuition for your schools is pretty steep. How would you help a family who kind of fits the, twice exceptionalities, but doesn't have the resources for the tuition? Do you work with those people?
We do. And it's a very frustrating situation right now because here, if you become a non-public school, then you can become eligible for government funding. But our children, with the standardized testing that they do, it's just not something that it works for them. And I, from an ethical standpoint, I won't do it to these kids. And because of that, we can't get government funds. And a lot of grants are tied up in that too. A lot of the people who are looking for innovative schools don't realize that they're really tying our hands. So we're a nonprofit, and very fortunately, we've had people who are helping us to kind of limp along and grow. And when we get donations, we are able to put that toward tuition support for families we do need based tuition support for families. They can apply through an organization called FAST, and if they whatever they can pay, they can pay. We just want the kids here. And I think that what you said about teachers and everyone's just doing their best, and it's a lot of very well-intentioned people. These are just they're very complex children, and the school systems themselves have even said that there just isn't they're kind of between a rock and a hard place with this particular group. So at least to get them in a foundation, a place where they can develop the foundation and they're not so stimulated, and for a little bit, I think is a good idea.
Do you have suggestions for the teachers that have 30 children in their room with one of these children? Is there a way that they can help these children to feel comfortable even though there's a lot of other children there?
I think, if they can establish a relationship with the child at the very beginning of the year, usually, they're kind of, they fly under the radar for a little while and then things start popping out. But if they can take the time to get to know, if they have had testing done and get to know what's going on with the child, and if they understand how the child's coping with their challenges, and, they can come up with a plan together for, okay, if you're really frustrated with an assignment, what's the signal you can show me? They just, I think if you respect the child and listen to them and come up with a plan together, you're going to be better off. That said, having 30 children in a classroom, is hard. And I think a lot of these kids need aids. A lot of them need voice to text, which you can't do with 30 kids in a class.
Right.
So it's just a tough deal.
It is. I agree with you. My own child, he's not, I don't think that his IQ would fit that model, and a lot of theories behind why it is the way it is, but I'm not going to go into that. But, you know, when he gets in a larger classroom, it's just so much for him. And then, you know, I almost hesitate to pull any child out of a regular classroom where they can be around other children that have, you know, different personalities and things. But for some reason, there are some children that just cannot handle the increasing class size numbers that are going on right now.
Right. And I have a niece. In fact, a lot of why I got into the field is because of my niece, who's in a similar situation as your son. And, you know, she spends a lot of time in classes, and she's not taking the information in at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's heartbreaking. I mean, she's getting ready to start her sophomore year, and she's not learning, which makes me angry, but we do want her happy
mm-hmm.
and well-adjusted in every way possible. So,
Okay. Well, I am definitely going to be picking your brain later about how you established your school. That is something that is desperately needed in the area that we're in. But I'm going to, we'll have a private conversation about that, I think. And I wanted to thank you for coming to, you know, talk to me, and give this information out to the people that listen. Can you tell people where they can go if they have more questions or need information about your school?
Certainly. And thank you so much for your time. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I'm happy to, if I can help, I absolutely want to. Our website is www.reidday.org, so readday.org. So anyone can contact me through the website if they have questions. We're here to support.
Great. And that was Dr. Reed from Reed Day Schools. This podcast will be posted on embracingthespectrum.com and posted on our social media channels. As we learn about the capabilities of our children with learning deficits, I find it promising to speak to people like Dr. Reed, who have found a method of helping children that have exceptionalities to learn. All children can learn. We just need to find the right way. Have a great day, and I look forward to putting more out there on these types of topics.
Thank you.